Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be having a chat about the Mutiny on the Bounty. Very, very famous incident indeed. You may have heard of it already. Where a group of British sailors mutinied while on board the Bounty. Yeah, kind of obvious what happened there. Pretty self-explanatory, really, when you think about it. But there's a lot going on in this story that you might not have heard about. The incident itself, as I say, pretty famous. Films and books and all sorts are based on it. But I'll bet you'll learn a thing or two after we give it the old half-assed history treatment, I tell you what. So what happened is this. 1789, while on a journey across the world, the crew of the HMS Bounty, they've headed up to the back teeth with their skipper, William Bligh, and as a result, a bloke named Fletcher Christian led a mutiny against him. Fletcher captured the ship and had all sorts of adventures with his mates, while Bligh and his mates had to survive after being cast adrift. And as I say, there's a lot going on. There's mutiny and betrayal, there's drunken hedonism, there's survival at sea, and of course, there's horrible murder. So let's get stuck in and find out what happened with the Mutiny on the Bounty all those years ago. We're going back all the way to 1784 here, when the ship that actually would become the Bounty was first built. She started out as a collier, as a coal ship called Bethia, but she was bought by the Royal Navy in 1787 and converted into a cutter, which is the smallest class of warship. Now, the Royal Navy had a very, very specific plan in mind when they made this purchase. They knew what they were going to do with the Bounty, obviously renamed it the Bounty. They want to sail it to Tahiti and pick up a big stack of breadfruit plants, which they then want to sail over to the Caribbean, as they reckon it'd be a big hit there as a source of cheap food. Now, Sir Joseph Banks of the Royal Society, you may have heard of this bloke. He had his dirty little fingers in a lot of British affairs around the turn of the 19th century. He travelled all over the world as a natural scientist. He helped establish the Royal Botanic Gardens in London, and even had a hand in the colonialisation of Australia. And as I've said before, he had his dirty fingers in a lot of British affairs. I'm not having a go at him here by saying he had dirty fingers. I mean, he's one of history's finest botanists. So if he was doing his job right, he would have had dirty fingers, you'd hope. Anyway, Sir Joseph Banks, he reckons that it's a good idea to get breadfruit growing over in the Caribbean, and so the expedition is organised. Now, obviously, breadfruit, maybe you're not 100% familiar with what this plan is all about. Again, not half-assed botany, it's half-assed history, and I don't understand exactly the ins and outs of this fruit, but the main reason the British want to transport it into the Caribbean is, again, as a cheap food source for all the slaves there. So they're thinking it's going to be an easy way to feed all of the people that are obviously working over there as slaves, all these poor souls over there. And so What Banks organises is this big expedition to go and get the breadfruit from one side of the world to the other. And this involves some very serious modification to the Bounty, principally the conversion of the captain's cabin, the great cabin, into this enormous big greenhouse, essentially designed to fit 1,000 potted breadfruit plants. Unbelievable. So you can imagine there, everyone can imagine, or you've seen pictures of or recreations of what a captain's cabin looks like. Imagine that, except they're turning into a greenhouse with skylights and glazed windows and drainage systems, all that sort of stuff. And this is the start of the problem already. Already we're running into one of the problems, one of the things that helped lead to the mutiny. So remember that little detail there about the conversion of the greenhouse there. Anyway, they picked this bloke named William Bligh to be in command of the expedition. Now, Bligh was a very experienced sailor. He'd been around the world already with Captain James Cook as chief navigator, and he'd been the captain of a merchant ship for a while as well. So he's definitely got a couple of years under his belt. He's 33 at the age of 33, but by the time that he's given the command of this new vessel, the Bounty. Now, it's difficult to say exactly what he is. He's the captain of the Bounty in the traditional sense, but technically speaking, he's not the captain when it comes to rank. He's a little sea captain, not a big sea captain, because the Bounty was too small a ship to have a command at the rank of captain. And Bligh, who, as I say, had been a big sea captain for a while now, he has to actually take a pretty big pay cut when he's named the first lieutenant of the Bounty. It's to do with the size of the ship. It was so small, it meant that he was the only commissioned officer. He was the only big head honcho on the ship. And there was a greatly reduced number of warrant officers, in other words, all the middle management there. And on top of this, to make things even worse for Bligh, and again, you can see where this is heading here, usually Royal Navy ships travelled with some number of Marines to enforce the captain's will. But again, the Bounty is too small for this. And so there's not an onboard, military presence to make sure that the captain gets his way. In any case, A crew is assembled for Bligh and for the bounty, and 46 of these blokes, they pile onto the ship in readiness for its departure. There's Bligh, of course, and there are four warrant officers. There's a ship surgeon, and there's a stack of midshipmen, or young blokes, hoping to climb the ranks, sort of apprentices, I guess you could call them there. And Bligh knows a fair few of these fellas already, as he's picked some of them himself, and he even sailed with some of the warrant officers under Captain Cook years ago. So along with all these officers and midshipmen, there's also a pair of botanists. These are civilians. They're not part of the Royal Navy, and they've come along to look after the plants, obviously, one of whom, his name is David Nelson, and he'd also sailed with Cook to Tahiti, so he knew some of the locals, he spoke a little bit of the language, and he had a good idea of what was going on in the world of plants down that side of the world. But aside from the officers and the midshipmen, there's all the usual crew. There's the quartermaster, the sailmaker, the armourer, the cook, and a great big load of what we call able seamen as well. So you know, a full complement of 46 people are on board the bounty there. And as soon as all of these blokes get on board the ship, they realise very, very quickly that it's a bit of a tight bloody squeeze. The modifications to the captain's cabin and the rest of the ship, of course, to cater for these breadfruit plants, mean that they're all living in, you know, sort of nuts to butts here in a bit short on living space, I think it's fair to say. The officers have got tiny little cramped cabins for themselves, but the bulk of the crew, they've got to squish themselves in like sardines into the forecastle, which is an area that's about 11 metres by 7 metres with 1.7 metres headroom. That's not even 6 foot. So they're really, really in, you know, as I say, packed in like sardines. So from the outset, you can see pretty bloody uncomfortable affair for them all. And it's safe to say that no one was particularly thrilled with the accommodation situation there. I think it's fair to say it's not getting many, many 5-star reviews on bloody TripAdvisor, I would say. Anyway, everything is readiness for departure. Despite all of this, everything's ready for departure in October 1787. But there are a series of delays that mean that the bounty isn't clear to sail until the end of November on the 28th. Now, this is a little bit of a problem because even when it does, bad weather means the ship doesn't leave British waters for almost a month. So we're well into December 1787 here before the ship is even sort of, you know, it's even en route, which is a pretty bloody terrible start. Now, the plan was to sail south around Cape Horn into the Pacific by way of South America, down the bottom there, near Antarctica, between the gap between Antarctica and South America. But the late departure means that this was going to be very tricky, as by the time that they sailed that far south, it would actually be approaching winter. By the time they made it to Cape Horn, it would already be into the winter months because, of course, obviously in the Southern Hemisphere, when we have the seasons and the months arranged properly, by the time you get to the middle of the year, it's obviously winter, which is, of course, the way that it should be rather than summer. In any case, they're off. Bligh, he doesn't waste any time in asserting his authority over the ship. He uses Captain Cook's very, very strict approach to things like cleanliness and nutrition. But apparently Bligh was pretty bloody over the top with all this. Captain Cook, generally regarded as, you know, a very skilled naval captain, and Bligh is looking to walk in his footsteps there, but apparently, again, as I say, a little bit over the top, you know, all this nonsense, bloody, like a bloody cafe manager, he's running around, wiping tables, checking on the food, all sorts of stuff there like that. And in fairness, there is another side to him because he also got the crew to have a bit of a sing and a dance and, you know, he did this quite often to keep everyone happy and exercised and all that sort of stuff. So overall, things are going quite well. They're going quite smoothly, even though Bligh is a bit of a disciplinarian. You know, things are, you know, cutting along quite well there as they sail south. Bligh wrote back to Joseph Banks that everyone was very happy and having a great time. But the exception to this, the one exception to this bloke, to this thing here, was one bloke, the ship's surgeon, a bloke named Thomas Huggin, who was both lazy and a drunkard, which is a real winner of a combination there. And also Bligh seemed to have had, he seemed to have become good mates with his young fella Fletcher Christian, even promoting him to his second in command above the navigator, John Fryer. He promotes Christian to acting lieutenant. Now, John Fryer, who was supposed to be the second in command of the ship, he didn't love this, wasn't a big fan of it, but he took it on the chin and he got on with it. What a trooper. But Christian, on the other hand, this young bloke who's been promoted like this, he's bloody loving life. He's going around like the cock of the walk, having a great time. But that's a minor detail we'll come back to because, to be honest, things aren't going great as well. As you know, as broadly speaking, if the ship is being run efficiently and smoothly, things are not going well from a sailing standpoint. In early April, they're approaching Cape Horn, and this is when the weather really starts to take a turn for the worse. Remember, as I say, they're heading into winter, the seasons, they're done properly in the Southern Hemisphere. We have winter in June, July, and August, like you're supposed to. And as a result of this, the weather is getting a bit choppy as they head down towards the bottom of South America. The Bounty tried and tried and tried to make headway further south, but this awful weather keeps blowing them off course. And more than once, they actually end up being blown back further north than they were than when they started. So finally, after about 2 weeks of this, Bligh, he's had enough. He's had enough of the weather's rubbish. He says, bugger this. Boys, look, turn around. Hard to bloody port. We are going to head to Tahiti via the Cape of Good Hope, via South Africa instead. Now, everyone on board is a big, big fan of this plan. It means no more freezing cold South American weather. Instead, it's a nice leisurely cruise through the Indian Ocean rather than, you know, this bloody Antarctic chill. So people very, very happy about that. So the Bounty heads off east, zipping along towards the southern end of Africa, having a great time. They make it to False Bay, which is just east of the Cape of Good Hope, by the end of May. And they hang out there for a couple of weeks, you know, sort of chilling out. The ship's stocks are replenished and some incidental damage is repaired, and Bligh sends off a bunch of letters and saying this isn't a joke, what they said. These letters explained how good of a job he was doing and how pleased everyone back at home should be, how proud of them he should be. This bloke obviously had tickets on himself, I tell you what. But anyway, after a month or so of chilling in False Bay, they set off once again on the 1st of July, 1788, this time cruising into the Indian Ocean. The next leg of the journey was a long one, and their next stop, of course, was Tasmania. Now, I can't imagine that would have been very good for morale. Already we got, we got Bligh sort of cracking the whip and keeping everyone on their toes. But, the sailors, they think, oh, great, we don't have to go around Cape Horn, we don't have to go through the freezing Antarctic blast of wintry chill and whatever else. And then they announce instead we're going to Tasmania. I mean, bloody hell, what's worse than that? I think you'd rather just have more of this, you know, the freezing cold weather in a tiny cramped cabin than have to go to bloody Tasmania. Ugh. I mean, you know, they're going blind. I said, mate, can we just skip it? Like, don't worry about supplies or whatever or fresh water. We'll just go hungry. Just don't make us, please don't make us stop at bloody Tasmania, please. Anyway, they get there no worries under 2 months later, and credit where credit is due, Bligh did a bang-up job of navigating through some pretty terrible winter weather, and he gets them there, no worries, landing at Adventure Bay on the 21st of August. Now, once again, they get the chance to stretch their legs on shore, and they do all the usual business of replenishing supplies, taking on water, all that sort of stuff. But it's here in Tasmania, that the first real cracks start to show between Bligh and some of the other people on the ship. Up until now, it had been relatively smooth figuratively speaking, it had been smooth sailing. Literally speaking, the sailing had been, you know, choppy as all hell, but the figurative sailing had been going as well as you could expect. There'd been a flogging or two and a couple of minor spats between sailors, but, you know, nothing too major. So when Bligh gets stuck into the carpenter, a bloke named William Purcell, it kicks off a bit of an undercurrent of discontent, I can tell you this. He seems to have had a real chip in his shoulder when it came to poor old Purcell, the carpenter there, because this is the first of many issues these two blokes have. The argument, just by the way, to sort of characterise what's going on, the argument was Bligh telling Purcell off for the way that he was chopping wood. Now, if someone came to me and tried to correct me on the way that I make history podcasts, I'd probably listen carefully and hope to learn something, because obviously I need all the help I can get. But what I'm trying to say here is that if I were a carpenter and some bloody knob comes up to me and says, listen, mate, have you ever tried bloody cutting wood with the other side of the axe or whatever? I don't know what Bligh said to Purcell. I'd be spitting chips. I don't know what Bligh was thinking, having a go at the carpenter like this, but I'll tell you this, it doesn't end well. Purcell refuses to budge. He's still using the proper end of the axe to cut the wood. And it actually takes Bligh threatening to cut his rations for Purcell to finally give in and start, I don't know, I'm making that up about him chopping the... I'm sure Bligh wasn't that stupid. He's saying, oh, chop the axe with the blunt end. I'll chop the wood with the blunt end of the axe. I don't think that's what he's doing. Anyway. Wasn't a great vibe. That's my point. It wasn't a great vibe to have going on the ship, because it only gets worse after this, of course. Obviously, it only gets worse. That's half-assed history in a nutshell. It only got worse after that. After they've set sail and they're heading towards Tahiti, more problems start to crop up. Fryer, the navigator, you'll remember, he was the bloke who was supposed to be second in command. He starts causing issues for Bligh there. He's refusing to sign the ship's accounting books until Bligh... has to really lay down the law. He gets everyone out and starts reading them the bloody Riot Act and, trying to force them to recognise his... He doesn't actually read the Riot Act. He reads the Royal Navy's Articles of War. But, you know, the effect is the same. And it doesn't go down too well, because Bligh, he's turning into a bit of an authoritarian here. He's turning a bit of a tyrant. To make things even worse, the biggest problem here is actually the ship's doctor, Huggin. You'll remember that he was a lazy drunkard, and he actually goes from bad to worse throughout the voyage here, because he's getting on the sores pretty bloody hard, and when he treats one of the sailors' asthma with bloodletting, the sailor actually dies of blood poisoning. Unbelievable. So this bloke, he's coughing and spluttering away, and old, you know, Dr. Drunkard here, he decides the best way to do it is with some 13th century medicine here by giving him a bloodletting. But rather than cop to it, right, Huggin actually tells Bligh, he says, oh, mate, yeah, no, that bloke with the asthma, no, definitely didn't accidentally kill him, no, not at all, he had bloody scurvy or something, mate, he had scurvy, needed some of them lime stuck into him, yeah, that was it, nothing to do with him, me bleeding him to death or anything. Hearing this, Bly forces everyone, because he thinks everyone's going to get scurvy, he forces everyone what I've learnt is called an anti-scorbutic regimen, a food and drink designed to prevent scurvy, which obviously didn't go down that well with the crew because scurvy wasn't a huge problem amongst the crew, obviously. The doctor's talking out his bum. But what Bly did as well is he also confiscated all of Huggins' booze, which sorted him out at least for a little bit, long enough for him to do his job properly. And one of the things he does do as part of his, you know, his duties as the ship surgeon, this is very important here. One of the things he does just before the Bounty reaches Tahiti is he gives all of the sailors medical examinations, which finds, and as I say, remember this because it'll come up again, no sign of venereal disease amongst anyone on board. Why am I telling you this? It will come clear very, very shortly indeed. Anyway. Unlike Dutch van der Linde, Bly does make it to Tahiti with his gang, or his crew, if we're going to be very specific with the terminology here, arriving safely on the 26th of October in 1788. Now, Bly might be, you know, a bit of a nasty boy, might be a bit of a tight-ass disciplinarian here, but he is a smart bloke nonetheless, and so the first thing he does after landing is try to make good with the locals. The bloke in charge, a chieftain named Chief Tyner, actually remembered Bly. They'd met before when Bly was sailing under Captain Cook. Tyner was a big, big fan of Captain Cook, and so he's pretty stoked to have Bly back for a visit. Oh, g'day, mate, how you going? Come in. No, I'll sit yourself down. I'll whack a pie in the oven, go grab a Milo for you, mate. No, good to see you. Very, very, you know, it's been a while, so, you know, what's been going on? He's also pretty stoked with the deal that Bly proposes to him. He says, Bly says, I want 1,000 of them breadfruit plants. You know, you got a million of them. You can spare us 1,000 of them. China, mate, come on. Give us 1,000 of them, and in return, I've got a whole bloody cargo load full of gifts, you know, gifts and prezzies and all sorts of stuff. And China's loving it. He's loving it. He's thinking, these bloody idiot British idiots, they come here, they want all those stupid plants. They're getting me all these presents. Oh, no worries at all. Take as many as you want. So Bly and his crew, they get to work. Now, Christian, the second in command, you remember, he's put in charge of organising a spot on shore where all the botanists can work on preparing and potting all of these plants. Now, this is going to be a long process. It'll take months and months and months. And so the crew of the Bounty, they settle in for a good old time in Tahiti. In real terms, what this essentially means is that most of the blokes from the Bounty, they go around more or less shagging anything that moves, and they end up getting more and more lax about their jobs around the ship. They're hitting the grog, they're partying, they're getting nice and cozy with the locals, as I say, and they're generally having a bloody great time. And initially, Bly didn't mind this too much because he realised it'd sort of piss off the crew much more if he tried to lay down the law. But once everyone gets used to this sort of easy breezy island living, Bly, he has a lot of trouble, you know, sort of getting them to do even their basic duties, because they're off at bloody Margaritaville, Jimmy Buffett, you know, having boat drinks, whatever else, having a great time and not wanting to actually put in the hard yakka that they're supposed to as members of the Royal Navy. Now, the bloke who hit it the hardest, surprise, surprise, no prize for guessing who the bloke was who was hitting the sauce the hardest, it was the good doctor, Huggin. He went at it very, very hard indeed, so hard, in fact, that he ended up dying. He drank himself to death quite literally in December, about 6 weeks after they landed. And as time went on, Bly became more and more of a hard ass about everything and started to order people who were particularly lazy or careless to be flogged, because so bad is the discipline amongst all of the crew that nothing's getting done. They're not actually, you know, adhering to this schedule of getting all these breadfruit plants prepared, potted up and ready to go in time for a departure. Now, you can imagine him going around flogging everyone. It's not the most popular decision he ever made. Oops. And so come January, some of the blokes actually try to bugger off. They try to desert. Three of these fellas, Muspratt, Churchill and Millward, they nick a boat. They nick some supplies and some weapons and they try to run away. Muspratt had just been flogged and he'd had enough and he goes, bugger this, I'm out of here. I'm going to go and live that. You know, again, Jimmy Buffett, bring it on. Going to sip margaritas and have a great time for the rest of my life here in the sunshine of Tahiti. But it was no good, unfortunately. I mean, sort of, not much came of it, unfortunately. We could have setting things up for a really good story here, but Muspratt kind of buggered it there. They were found 3 weeks later and they were flogged again for, you know, good measure. So Bly's consistent, if nothing else. Anyway, Bly's crackdown meant that a lot of the crew, they did actually sharpen up eventually. Obviously, they didn't want to have their hides tanned there. And so they get up and about and they get more work done. And by February, over 1,000 breadfruit plants have been potted and have been transferred over to the ship. And this wasn't the only thing the crew had been transferring. I'll tell you this. Of course, they're doing the good work with the breadfruit. They're getting it potted up. They're moving it into the greenhouse, making sure all that's ready to go, transferring that to the ship. The other thing, however, they are transferring into the ship. Well, remember the doctor gave them all a clean bill of health in the downstairs department before disembarking to Tahiti? Well, now almost 20 of the crew members have, shall we say, they have earned the wages of sin and are having an itchy old time in their jocks, I will tell you that. So they're getting busy in more ways than one. However, any way you slice it, no one really wanted to leave Tahiti. That is the long and the short of it. They'd enjoyed a very, very relaxed and pleasant lifestyle for 5 months as they were getting these plants ready, with nice weather, good company, and you know, not a lot of work to do. But once the plants are all transferred, that's all coming to an end, right? They're staring down the barrel of months in cramped, overcrowded conditions, nowhere to escape from Bligh's, you know, who is becoming more and more of a crazy authoritarian here, and a lot of the sailors aren't very happy to have to walk back onto the ship and sail off. But Bligh, he's very, very keen to set sail. Everyone else, dragging their feet. They don't want to leave, but you know, obviously they finally have to. And on the 5th of April in 1789, they finally set sail away from Tahiti. They're packed up, you know, last little smooch for the missus, the Tahitian missus there, packed up the bags, onto the ship they go with 1,000 breadfruit plants in the great cabin, and off they go, setting sail back towards Britain. However, pretty bloody bad vibes on the ship. I'll tell you this, pretty rubbish atmosphere that the Bounty is sailing under there as it sets off westward there, back across the Pacific Ocean towards the Indian Ocean there. Now, Bligh seems to have gone a bit bloody mental by now, to be honest. After trying to sort of wrangle a pack of horn dogs back on Tahiti, he's apparently stepped up his crazy man behaviour pretty significantly. Obviously, he had these tendencies beforehand, but now there's a little bit of discontent, a little bit of, you know, all this this tension bubbling away under the surface. Bligh's having a pretty bad time. And so what he starts doing, he starts prowling about. He starts, you know, trying to catch people doing the wrong thing. And once he does, he bellows at him. He'd bellow at someone for stuffing something up, and then he'd go back to normal next minute, as if it never happened. Now, poor old Fletcher Christian, who used to get on with Bligh pretty well, as you'd say, promoted to the second in command and given all these extra responsibilities, duties, whatever else, he starts getting targeted a fair bit by Bligh. All of this rage from William Bligh is being targeted here at Christian, and so he's a very unhappy chappy, as you might imagine, if you know, the captain's coming down him like a ton of bricks here. And nonetheless, under this very tense atmosphere, they continue to sail on, and they reach modern day Tonga on the 22nd of April. Now, Christian, in Tonga, he is sent out to gather some supplies with a small group of blokes, although Bligh forbids him from using any weapons when dealing with the locals, who are known to be a little bit aggro sometimes, so Christian's not too happy about this. And I'll tell you this, doesn't go well for him either. Doesn't go well for Christian, because the locals, as he's approaching going into Tonga, you know, going to try, oh, g'day, mate, how you going? You just want to grab some water, maybe some chooks, whatever else, grab them, stick them onto our big boat there. He actually starts getting threatened by these locals. They, Christian and his mates, they start getting threatened, and they're actually forced back towards the Bounty. So they, you know, they don't get their head smashed in. These guys have to sort of beat a hasty retreat there. And Bligh rips Christian a new one. He calls him a damned cowardly rascal, which is some pretty bloody foul language in the 18th century. Let me remind you of that. So Bligh is getting harder and harder to put up with. He's endangering his crew, sending him off to deal with potentially hostile locals, forbidding them the use of weapons, and generally doing a good job of keeping everyone very, very unhappy here. And he's, as I say, getting harder and harder to put up with as they leave the islands behind. They're heading towards the straits between modern-day Australia and Papua New Guinea. But it's here that Christian, he's had enough of it. The last straw comes on the 27th of April when, unbelievably, Bligh has a go at Christian for, this is not a joke, he has a go at him for nicking coconuts from his private supply. I think Bligh, who, you know, is probably a few coconuts short of a palm tree in both a figurative and a literal sense here, he might be losing it, to be honest. He might be losing his marbles. And as a result of this alleged theft of these coconuts, right, he punishes the whole crew. And now I can tell you, Christian has had it up to the back teeth. He's sick to death of all this nonsense from the captain. So he goes to Purcell, the carpenter, who also doesn't like Bligh, and he gets a bunch of wood, and he starts to build himself a little raft. He's decided to bugger off, live on an island with the locals there, and again, get back to that good Margaritaville living. However, he's stopped by a bunch of other people on the ship. Some of them suggest that instead of fleeing, Christian, mate, how about this? Lead a mutiny. Seize control of the Bounty from Bligh. We are 100% behind you, my friend. Let's get it done. Now, emboldened by this show of support from some of his crew members there, Christian decides, oh, yeah, bugger it. I'll tell you what, let's kick off a mutiny, see how it goes. Hey, well, you know, what's the worst that could happen? So, early in the morning on the 28th here, Christian, he creeps out of his quarters. He meets up with a bunch of the other willing mutineers, and he commandeers all the ship's muskets, and they all sneak up to Bligh's cabin there. Bloody, you know, balaclavas on, gloves on, mission impossible. Probably not the balaclavas and the gloves, probably not Mission Impossible theme playing in their ears, but still trying to paint a picture for you here. And the mutineers, They burst into his room and they grab Bligh and they tie his hands and they warn him to be quiet if they value his life. They put a bayonet to his chest and they say, mate, look, what you make one false move and you're a dead man. Bligh has a bit of a think about this. He has a think about it. He goes, oh, they've told me to be quiet or I'm going to die. Better not resist anything. No, bugger it. No. He starts yelling at the top of his lung for someone to come in and rescue him. Now, even the people who remained loyal to Bligh, however, they are not going to mess with Christian and the heavily armed mutineers as they drag poor old Bligh out onto the quarterdeck there. And so everyone has just sort of stood about watching on or running about trying to figure out what's going on. They've all come out for a good old look, as I say, and there's a lot of chaos as they're all trying to figure out exactly what's going on. They're running around, shouting, bumping into each other, trying to figure out which side people are on or even which side they themselves are on. But at the head of all of this is Christian. He's armed with a bayonet, and by some reports even, he has this great big heavy sounding weight tied around his neck in case the mutiny went south so he could chuck himself overboard, kill himself by drowning, right? So he's got a kill switch ready to go. But Bligh, he's still carrying on like a pork chop. People are running around like headless chooks, yelling and shouting, and Bligh's trying to get people to come and give Christian a hiding and release Bligh and all that sort of stuff, but no one does it. No one wants to mess with Christian. Eventually, Christian gives the order that Bligh and those who want to go with him are to be let go. They're going to be set adrift on a small dinghy. Now, the dinghy that they pull out ends up being damaged. It's not a seaworthy vessel, however. So Christian, who's a decent bloke, he says, no worries, mate. Don't even worry about it. We'll whack you and your mates in that big launch boat over there. That can fit 10 people easily. Now, what Christian didn't realise, however, is just how many people didn't want to stick around with the mutineers. He thought, okay, launch boat, they've got a launch that can fit, 10 or so people in it. That'll be enough. But no. More than half the people on the Bounty, they don't want to be involved with his mutiny. And so they try to leave with Bligh on a boat that, as I say, was meant for just 10 people. Christian swoops in and he makes some executive decisions. He prevents the carpenter's mates from joining Bligh. He prevents the armourer as well, because obviously he wants these blokes aboard the Bounty to help him out instead. And they're not fans of this, I can tell you. They beg to be let go, but Christian says, no. And Bligh, he says, I'll tell the authorities back in Britain that they resisted the mutiny. He says, never fear, lads, I'll do you justice if I ever reach England. So all the people who can fit onto this launch, they pile on with Bligh. They don't want to be part of this mutiny, of course, which is punishable by death if they're ever caught again by the British. They really don't want to be on the wrong end of that stick there. And so a bunch of them, they pile into this boat and they are cast off from the Bounty just like that. Now, Bligh and his loyalist mates, they're set adrift in this tiny boat, but they do have, they managed to scrounge a sextant, a pocket watch to navigate with, and 5 days' worth of supplies that they're given by the mutineers. There are 19 of them all told, leaving just 25 people behind on the Bounty. And just before the lines are cut and the launch sails away, the mutineers, they chuck down a couple of cutlasses to Bligh and his mates, but that is it. Sextant and a pocket watch to navigate with, 5 days' worth of supplies, and 4 cutlasses. And these guys are left in the vast emptiness of the Pacific to fend for themselves. Bligh raises the boat's very small sail and heads off towards a nearby island. He knows they can see it in the distance. There's a plume of smoke rising from the distance. They know that there's a little island called Tofua over 50 kilometres away there. And Christian, meanwhile, has full command of this cutter, the Bounty, and he now has to decide what he's going to do next. And that, my friends, is where we're going to leave the story for this week. We have Bligh on his launch there, trying to figure out what he's going to do, going to go and try to head over to Tofua and figure out if he's going to be able to make it back to Britain in one piece. And Christian, living life on Easy Street. Big ship, all his, and all the seven seas are at his disposal. He can go wherever he wants and do whatever he wants. And next week, we will find out what both of these blokes got up to. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of the mutiny on the Bounty so far. And next week, as I say, of course, we'll discover what happened after the mutiny and what the ultimate fate of Captain Bligh and Fletcher Christian were after this whole thing took place. So Until then, of course, the usual boring housekeeping nonsense at the end of the show, halfasshistory.net. You can find previous episodes there. It's also the best way to get in touch with the show. There's a little contact form by which you can contact me. And I very much appreciate, I love reading through all the emails that I get. Thank you so much to everyone who's getting in touch with other little details and bits and pieces about episodes that I put out and whatever else. So again, thank you very, very much indeed to everyone who's doing that. And of course, always looking for new episode suggestions. So please do send through your ideas. I've still got plenty of stickers to send out if you want them, so send me through your address and I'll shoot them through to you free of charge. That's easy enough. And I'd really appreciate if you wouldn't mind just telling people about the show. I'm trying to grow the audience just a little bit here, and if you want to share the stories of Half Ass History with anyone else, best way to do that, send them through to the website and they can listen to the episodes themselves. Very exciting news as well. I finally figured out. How to get the podcast on Spotify. Now, I'm recording this obviously in advance, so it should be up by now. It should be up on Spotify by now. I very much hope it is. But if it's not, I'll be troubleshooting it. But of course, Spotify, one of the best ways to consume podcasts, and certainly the way that I do it as well. So if you are a fan of the app Spotify, have a look, because Half Ass History should be there now. Anyway, that's enough boring nonsense from me. Of course, going to leave you as ever with a question posed on Reddit, this time a science question. We've talked a little bit about botany, of course, bringing all of those breadfruit plants across from one side of the world to the other. So a science question here posed by Reddit scientist Wisier. Does the word plant mean plant because plants are planted, or does planting mean planting because we plant plants?